Has the trauma passed? I think it has. That is April Sun in Cuba by the legitimate singers of that song, Dragon. Time now is 11 past the hour. We will be unlocking over 600 languages to explore what are the groups of words, the nouns, the topics that have the greatest prevalence in each of those languages. We're not going to step through them all, but I have teased you with what language has the most synonyms and variations and nuances for love, which for fish and which for mountains, and also too, if you've got a favourite word from another language, you can also join us and tell us what that is too. 1300 222 774, and feel free to guess on those languages as well on the text 0437 774 774.
G'day, this is Macca, and Sunday's your day.
I've got some roosters, and I want to know if your program will help me get them to some farms. They're lovely, they're handsome brutes. I don't want them to go to a pot, Macca.
Give us a ring and say g'day to Australia. ABC Radio and the ABC Listen app.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker,
and on your radio.
This is ABC Radio
with David Astor.
Well, credit to Matt Tribe who found this story. My eyes lit up when I saw what an intriguing, multifaceted study it is. It's all to do with languages. It's all to do with the various cultural biases of language. Professor Charles Kemp has been part of the research team from the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. And we are looking at all the various languages, over 600 languages, and seeing what are the sort of interesting variations and points, probably the deepest pockets of language that exist in those 600 plus. Charles, I have to say, I mean, congratulations. What an ambitious study. How long has this been up and running, looking at over 600 languages?
We've been working on this general idea for nearly a decade now, and I really want to pay tribute to Temulin Kishiksuran, who took the lead on this, and it wouldn't have happened without her amazing efforts over the past couple of years.
Well, well said. Now, we have been asking people what the three languages that that we could choose, any one of these languages, because the paper, has this in fuller extent. But the language that has the most for love, a couple of people have been guessing for that. One person that's lived from Strathbogie, soon to be Tasmania. I'm guessing it might be Polish. That I'm presuming, Liv, that is for love, because Polish people, well, perhaps they love their fish too, but the fish one... Charles, do you know what the fish one is?
Fijian and Hawaiian both have many terms for
they
fish.
They do. Well done. Fijian and Hawaiian. I think Hawaiian also has got many, many for bananas. The one for mountains, the one for love is Hindi, which is beautiful. Although this one, Suresh Rajan in Perth, I'm thinking fish might be Sri Lankan. I have to say, Suresh, I, having enjoyed Sri Lanka 5 months ago now, lots of fish there, so that's a good guess. And the other one, mountains. Which is the language that has the most mountains in it, Charles?
Well, the linguist Paul Zinsley wrote an entire monograph on Swiss German terms for mountains, so they would be up there.
This is incredible, because the research has been looking at over 1,500 different digital lexicons, and I suppose that's been, in a way, has opened up much more potential for wider, deeper research. Where have you even found these lexicons? Because they're not easy to come across.
Well, the real resource for us was the HathiTrust Digital Library, which is a collection of nearly 18 million volumes. So one of the things we did is go through that list and use some computer programs to pull out the bilingual dictionaries, the dictionaries of interest to us.
I've also been asking people what their favourite word is from another language, and Helen joins us now in South Melbourne. Good evening, Helen.
Hello, David, and guess whose name I missed?
Charles, that's all right.
Charles. Mm-hmm. Look, my favourite word in Italian is zuccheriera. Zucchero for sugar is so straightforward. Oh, only the Italians can make it into about 17 syllables. Zuccheriera.
It's a great word. Now, is that to say that it means something sugar plus? Is it a compound with sugar?
Zuccheriera? Sugar ball.
Sugar ball. Aha.
Ball, B-O-W-L.
I like sobremesa, which is basically what takes place after a meal, where everyone just sort of gathers around and keeps talking. A little bit with that fatigue and languor of a fine Italian meal. That's one of my favourites.
Love the subject matter, David. Yeah. It's wonderful.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Lovely to hear
Thank
from you,
you,
Helen. Keep well. What's one of your favourites from another language, Charles?
We've been thinking recently about words for snow. So one of my favourites refers to snow in a place where it's not meant to be. It's the word itrugta from a dictionary of Central Alaskan Yupik, and it means powdery snow that's blown in between the boards of a house.
That's a gorgeous word, and so specific, and I guess this is one way of measuring whether the so-called Inuit proclivity for words of snow, most variations, now that you've been rummaging around sort of 600-plus languages, is that the case? Do Inuit languages have the most words for snow?
Well, we find evidence for that. The claim has been controversial because it depends on what you mean by a word and how you should count things. But what we found is that in our data set of more than 600 languages, the five Inuit languages that we had in the data set were all among the top 20 in terms of the strength of their connection with the concept snow.
Interesting you make that point about assessing what a word is. Is that to say that you may be finding a word for snow that sits in what a phrase or a collocation of words? It's hard to actually gauge when a word starts and a phrase begins.
That's right. So this happens even for English. If you think about words like snowfall or snowflake or snowdrift, do you count those as three separate words or not? And this is even more relevant for polysynthetic languages like Inuit languages. There, something like a phrase, there were many places to make fishing holes in the ice. All of those ideas could be glued together into a single word. And so this is why the claim has been controversial, because arguably there's an infinite number of words for snow in Inuit languages, just as there are an infinite number of phrases involving snow in English.
Says Dave, my guess for the words would be for bananas, France. So bananas, my guess for the words would be bananas, France for fish, Greece for mountains. It's actually Swiss German, which is amazing, but Greece has some incredible mountains. And German, well, German, Dave, actually. Well, mountains with German. Sorry, Dave, I misread your text. It came out a little bit higgledy-piggledy, but you're close with your guess for German, Swiss German, Dave, so I'll give you that one. German, on the other hand, what's the prevalence in German?
Well, the anthropologist Per Hager wrote a chapter on Munich terms for beer and charted this elaborate vocabulary that the Munichers have.
I'm wondering what Australian English might be. Just a couple of thoughts on that one. But how would you even begin to sift? I understand that it's bilingual dictionaries, but let's say you get a Polish-English bilingual dictionary. How would you determine what is the group of words that has the deepest list?
Well, one wrinkle is most of the dictionaries in our data set are under copyright, so we can't get our computer to actually read all the definitions, which we would have liked to do. Instead, what we do is analyze word frequencies. So for a given dictionary, we can say, how many times does snow or chocolate or banana appear in the dictionary? And those are the statistics that we use to compare the different languages.
But that would take a fair amount. Are you doing any speculation? So if I was looking, for example, at Turkish English, I would think, okay, well, Turkish, let's think about what are some of the hallmarks of Turkish culture. It might be dress, it might be food, it might be cigars, it might be desserts. I'm just trying to work out how would you even begin to draft a list of suspected terms.
So this is a good question. We turned to the literature for that, and Temulin went through the literature and gathered nearly 400 different claims already in the literature. So they included Swiss German words for mountains, some of the ones we talked about. So in the first part of our study, we set out to test those claims and see to what extent they were supported by our data. And most of them were.
My guest is Professor Charles Kemp from the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. David Astor with you on ABC Evenings across Victoria and Western Australia. It's 20 past the hour. We are looking at a study that Charles and his colleagues have conducted at the university, looking at over 600 languages and trying to measure the most interesting finds and the most interesting word groups within each of those languages. Charles, one of the challenges of this, I suppose, is one of the surprises, let me say, is that you're not from the School of Languages, but you're from the School of Psychological Sciences. Tell me about how your own discipline, the faculty itself, has been drawn to this study. What's been motivating the study?
I think many psychologists, including me, are interested in categorization, so how we organize our world into categories. And some psychologists study that by doing experiments in the lab where you expose people to artificial stimuli and you see how they group them into categories. To me, it seemed more exciting to go out into the world and see what named categories exist in languages and how they vary across the languages of the world. So that was my path towards working on this.
There must have been some of the some surprises along the way. For all the usual suspects, there must be one or two outliers that surprised the group. Does one spring to mind?
Well, I can tell you one thing that surprised me, which suggests that making these predictions about which concepts are emphasized in languages isn't always common sense. So it is the case that the languages with the most extensive snow-related vocabularies tend to be languages from very cold regions. Yep. So no surprise there. We thought by analogy it might be the case that the languages with the most extensive set of words related to rain might be in the rainiest parts of the world. But we found that not to be the case. If you look at the words with the languages with the most rain-related words, some of them are from South Africa. And the languages in that region tend to have many words that relate to the absence of rain. So words relating to looking forward with anticipation for the rainfall and so on. So I think the difference there is that if you're in an area without snow, there's no reason for you to talk about it. If you're in an area where rain is sparse, you might be talking and thinking about it a great deal because your survival depends on that.
That's a really interesting observation, and possibly you are valuing it even more acutely than someone in the Democratic Republic of Congo who's being absolutely rained upon every second day.
That's right, valuing it in its absence.
Yeah, value in absence. Paul in Fremantle, WA. Hi, Charles and David. Salutations. Love your work and love Italian fish. Italian fish, Japanese mountains. I should say, it's just okay. So, fish is Japanese. Well, you're very close, actually, Paul, because Japanese has a preponderance of words relating to taste, I understand, Charles. So, I'm going to give you that as a win, Paul. That's a one in. So, Japanese has got plenty for taste. Mountains, Nepalese, again, a very smart guess. And favorite word? Well, it'll have to be the Japanese word, which is kuchisabashi. Which is, I'm not eating because I'm hungry, but my mouth is lonely. That reminds me, I think in Japanese it's got some ajitori, which is a bad haircut. I love the fact that there's one word for a bad haircut in Japanese. And wabi-sabi, which is the beauty of flawed things, that something is even more cherishable because of its imperfections. Another, I have come across a book that looked at what were the favourite words of some well-known authors, Charles. I'm not sure if you've come across this book before. It was a book called about Vladimir Nabokov's favourite word is mauve by a linguist called, I think his name was Ben Blatt. And he made the point that looking at the gender divide in some of the ways that language is used in literature, it seems as though male characters are more likely to grin and shout, whereas female characters are more likely to shiver and scream. So there can be a real, I guess, a sexism or a gender bias in language. How is that? How are you clarifying the speakers of these words? And maybe is there any consideration given to that about, while a word may exist in one particular language, is it only uttered by one cohort or one gender?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It's not something that we could look at because we were analyzing dictionaries only, but in other studies, people look at actual language usage. So you go out into the world and you measure who is saying what. And I think those kinds of statistics reveal some interesting differences. One paper I'm familiar with suggests that women on average tend to have a more extensive set of terms for colors than men do, and you can speculate about the reasons for that.
And probably a lot more for taste as well. And what about, it? Again, probably something not something that one could do, but I'm wondering is it something that has been discussed within the psychological studies, and that is to try and work out where word scarcities are?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting because if you look at any language, there are places where there are many words and surprising places where there are holes. So if you take English, we have a word which means to throw somebody out a window, which is rather remarkable. On the other hand, there's no term for the day after tomorrow or the day before yesterday.
It's so true.
And many other languages have terms for those concepts.
And yet we're happily to defenestrate people, but we can't say I'm going to meet you on Saturday. We'll have to say Saturday rather than the day after tomorrow.
Yeah.
Also, too, looking at Marshallese, which is up there in the Oceanic language group, has got a really deep list of words relating to smell. So once you establish that, what does that tell you?
Well, it helps you start to, well, continue to think about the reasons why languages have extensive smell vocabularies. Mm-hmm. So one thing that was interesting to us about Marshallese, previous work has looked at smell vocabulary in some detail, and it's well known that, say, there are languages in Southeast Asia, Thai is one of them, that have extensive smell-related vocabularies. As far as we know, no one had identified oceanic languages, languages of the Pacific, as a place where there are many smell-related terms. So this was a surprising and interesting discovery that our data pointed us towards.
Latif wants to know about are you a linguist as well? I mean, you've clearly got a great appetite and a great erudition around language. Is it something that you've also studied in, Charles?
I have no formal training in linguistics. I wish I did. I am able to collaborate with people like Temulin, the lead author on this, who is a bona fide linguist.
Also, too, a question with that notice is First Nation languages here. Is part of the 600 plus languages that have been sifted and assessed, has that included First Nation languages here in Australia?
Yes, that's right. I think there are on the order of 20 languages in our data set. And one of the interesting cases there is some of the languages spoken around Arnhem Land. Not surprisingly, they have an extensive vocabulary for kangaroos and wallabies. Something that really struck me and intrigued me was the linguist Murray Gard documented that there's also an extensive vocabulary for including words specifying how these different animals move. So if you think about black wallaroo, there'd be a different word for a male black wallaroo, a female black wallaroo, and probably different verbs referring to the hopping motions of those two creatures that distinguish them from the hopping motions of other wallabies and kangaroos.
And then we have the other hurdle, I suppose, when it comes to identifying the words that are the most prevalent. And how do you start to filter out the noise of language? Because sometimes language can be busy with all its articles and prepositions and pronouns. So how do you identify that those are not sort of like the particles of language rather than the key nouns and the key verbs?
We were looking mainly at counts for English words. So the idea was in a bilingual dictionary, we're really interested in the parts where the words are defined in English. And because of that, we can use existing data sets that specify whether words are nouns or verbs and adjectives. And in fact, in most of our analyses, we focus on words that are classified as nouns, just to make the task a little bit easier.
What's the next step, Charles?
We're really excited in working towards a data set that includes fully machine-readable dictionaries, because I think that would open up a large space of possibilities. I'm also excited about looking at some particular areas like words for clouds. That's one of interest to me.
And why so?
I was reading about, I think, a language spoken in Central Australia, which had 8 to 10 different words for clouds, and it just intrigued me. Clouds are interesting because there aren't really clear divisions between types of clouds. So there's an element of subjectivity there, I think.
Also, too, I think we've gained a new word for cloud in recent years. I think Macquarie's, one of their words of the year a couple of years ago now was pyrocumulonimbus, which are clouds formed by intense heat of bushfires. So we're gaining cloud vocabulary as well.
Yeah, well, I wish we hadn't gained that particular.
Yeah, I think we all feel like that. It's also an interesting thing too about how the changing world of these languages and of the earth itself has influenced vocab. Again, another potential study area. It's been really fascinating, I have to say. There's so much to enjoy about this conversation, so much about the research, which is ambitious and 10 plus years. Over 600 languages, 616. And are you still accumulating? You're still collecting and sifting as well?
We are. We're thinking about collecting dictionaries that are not under copyright so we can actually process them in full.
My guest has been Professor Charles Kemp from the School of Psychological Sciences at the University of Melbourne. And the conversation piece, which I can recommend because it really gives you a lot more insights into what languages have got those pockets and proclivities of words and word groups, is called Do Inuit Languages Really Have Many Words for Snow? And Charles Kemp is one of the co-authors and one of the collaborators on this ambitious and fascinating study. Great to have you in, Charles. Thanks again for dropping by.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Time now is 29 minutes to 10. Coming up, we're going